Good afternoon and welcome.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. We begin today with a conversation about parental accountability when juveniles commit violent crimes. Yesterday, in a courtroom in Pontiac, Michigan, Jennifer and James Crumbley were each sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison for failing to prevent their son from killing four students in a 2021 mass shooting at Oxford High School. Legal experts say it's the first time that parents of minors who commit murder have been convicted of involuntary manslaughter, and it could serve as a model for other cases around the country. Here in Maryland, on Sunday morning, Howard County police arrested five teenagers and charged them with armed robbery and carjacking. And last week in Baltimore, City State's Attorney Ivan Bates announced the arrests of 20 juveniles, he says, are responsible for 53 crimes over a period of several months, including armed carjacking, armed robbery, and assault. Bates stressed that his office will hold parents accountable for the illegal actions of their young children. Bates said, quote, "If you are found to be contributing to the delinquency of a minor child, my office will look to charge you." State's Attorney Bates was not available to join us today, but we will have him back on midday soon. And today I want to explore the view of many who work in the field of child welfare that Mr. Bates' approach to parental accountability will be counterproductive. My guests are two leaders of the Sarah and Neil Meyerhoff Center for Families, Children, and the Courts at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Aubrey Edwards-Luce is the center's executive director. Aubrey, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Chantra Trivedi is an assistant professor of law and the center's faculty director. Chantra, nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, if they join us in Studio A, you can join us on the phone. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org. So Chantra, let me start with you. You disagree with Ivan Bates and his approach to parental accountability, holding them responsible, charging them with crimes. How come?
Well, I think Mr. Bates he's a politician, right? And he is taking a position that he might think is politically popular. It sounds tough. It will make a lot of constituents happy. But what
it is definitely politically popular.
Yeah. And unfortunately, what it won't do is actually help these kids or their families, right? It doesn't actually respond to the problem that he says he's trying to solve. And this is not the first time that we had something sensational in the news get this kind of response, right? We often respond to policy based on these outlier cases. And nobody wants our kids to be committing carjackings, but our response has to be thoughtful. And it has to be data-driven. We can't be reactionary.
So, Aubrey, is it outlier? I mean, these are 20 kids. It's a big group. 53 crimes over the period of a couple of months. I mean, there were entire neighborhoods who were really, really terrorized by these carjackings and assaults and armed robberies. This is serious stuff. These are young kids, but serious stuff.
Without a doubt, this is the type of behavior and harm to community that nobody wants to say is okay. And it's not okay. But I think, you know, what's really important is for us to consider the entire timeline, right? When we think about, you know, is juvenile crime going up? Is it going down? There is a broader story here. What we saw during the end of last year, early parts of this year, was a blip in time. We've, over the past 10 years, juvenile crime has gone down. Even juvenile violent crime has gone down. But we did see a spike in this one instance. And so what I think is really important is that we keep the context of that and to really address it as this one instance, as opposed to making policy based on this critical and definitely harmful period of time in our recent history.
Mm-hmm. And Chantra Trivedi, what should be done with these 20 kids? What should happen now?
Well,
under the best of circumstances, in your view?
I think the approach has to be multifaceted, right? We can't just focus on the short term. We have to focus on both the short and long term. And you know, we need to invest in programs like the Tackling Chronic Absenteeism program that Aubrey can talk more about as executive director. You know, there are programs already in existence that are dealing with the underlying causes of these types of behavior. But, you know, we also recognize that Mr. Bates is a prosecutor, right? His purview is limited to what his office is in charge of. And we also know that incarceration is, it will ruin most of these children's lives forever, right? So we have to look at what alternatives exist. So I think, what would I want for my child? You know, I think, you know, we were just talking about this a little bit before, right? The language that's been used surrounding this case has really been very good at sort of moving away from this idea that these are children that we're talking about. And I always think, what would I want for my child, right? And I think if my child did something wrong, I would want them to listen to the person that they hurt. I would want them to apologize. I would want them to take responsibility. I would want them to change.
Would you have any responsibility if your child did something wrong? Because these are children. These are not kids who are making adult decisions, and you're the parent.
Yeah, I do have responsibility, but I also think that I am a very privileged parent. And the resources that I have with which to provide my children every opportunity that they could want is not the reality for most of the parents that we're talking about. And that is part of the reason that this parental accountability type response is so short-sighted, because we're telling parents, you need to be responsible for systemic issues, right? Most of the parents that we're talking about are low income. They're working multiple jobs. They are doing their best to keep food on the table. And the response that we're providing is to say, oh, DJS, go in and ask these parents.
That's Department of Juvenile Services.
Yes, sorry. Uh-huh. You know, Mr. Bates said the first step would be to send DJS in the Department of Juvenile Services to assess what the family needs and to provide supports. But what we know from working for years with families in the system is that the supports that organizations like that entities like DJS and the Department of Homeland Services can provide are limited, right? And it's sort of a menu. And if that's not what you need, then you don't get anything. And really what these parents need are concrete supports. They need access to childcare. They need better access to employment that pays a reasonable wage. They need their kids need better opportunities for employment and better educational opportunities. We need better after-school programs. Kids get into trouble when they're bored, right? And there are models that already exist that we can talk about, but we can't say that DJS will provide you some program that you never asked for. And the other part of that is that often these programs are coercive. So if you say that you want the help and then it turns out that you're not able to comply, or your life is turned upside down for any number of reasons, you are then punished. And mm-hmm. this idea that we're going to respond with, you know, assessment and services really is going to lead to a further culture of punishment and surveillance.
And Aubrey Edwards-Luce, I'm not sure Mr. Bates would disagree with what Shanta just said. I mean, he said at the press conference, this is a quote from the Baltimore Sun, this is a press conference he held last Wednesday about the arrest of these 20 juveniles. He said, we must start addressing the offenders in this age group with services and support, not simply sending them back home to repeat their actions over and over again, which has been the status quo of the system that's been failing them for so long. Let's move from catch and release to catch and assess. So where is the difference between you and Mr. Bates?
So I'd say that the difference is that who is doing the work, I think, is really what's underlying this. When we are talking about government agencies that are coming in to do assessments, those assessments are also happening with a level of power difference between the family and the agency, right? So it's very different than when my organization goes in to interact with a family in a very voluntary way. Our Tackling Chronic Absenteeism program, we are able to work with the family. We let them know you are a part of designing what services your family needs. And we're able to, because of all the generous like support that we have, we are oftentimes able to do a lot of those concrete supports, whether that's like helping families have housing. Whereas when you are working with the Department of Juvenile Services, they are able to tell you, we've got these six different things. And if you don't want one of these six different things, then we're going to say that you're not compliant with these services. And now we're in this position where they can refer you to have more prosecution. And with the outcome of the case in Michigan this past week, that level of anxiety and concern around deeper and deeper criminal involvement is increasing for sure.
Because this is exactly, Shanta Trivedi, what Mayor Brandon Scott has been saying. We're going to offer you help. We're going to offer you help with transportation, with housing, with job opportunities. We're going to offer you an alternative to a life of criminal activity. And if you don't take us up on it, we're going to throw you in jail. That's his pitch. That his pitch is with this group violence reduction strategy. And when you look at the data, something's working. You know, I don't know if it's specifically GVRS or what, but there are fewer people getting shot and fewer people dying because they've been shot than in the over the last couple of years. So it is a carrot and a stick. So there is a power differential. I don't disagree with Aubrey at all about a power differential when the Department of Justice sits somebody down and says, all right, here's your options. Mm-hmm. But there, we're talking about the law being broken, number one. We're talking about other people being terrified and sometimes assaulted and hurt. We're talking about their property being stolen. I mean, these are illegal acts. And whether it's the kids or the parents or some combination, the question is, what does accountability look like? And how does accountability play into stopping the behavior?
Well, I think this word accountability we've heard over and over and over and over, right? And it's, I don't know that anyone knows what accountability means. And it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people.
Yeah, because that's why I'm asking you what it means to
you.
Yeah,
well, I think, you know,
because for a lot of people, it means throw them in jail.
Yeah,
you break the law and you get punished. Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think, well, Mr. Bates says accountability in this case is we're going to charge you with contributing to the delinquency of a minor, right? And in that context, both accountability and contributing to the delinquency of a minor are really vague terms, right? So our concern is that, and what the research shows is that when we throw vague terms like that around, they're used most often against those who are most marginalized, low-income people and people of color. And in terms of what parental accountability looks like, I think it is, how do we put, how do we give resources to community-based organizations that can work with the family in the ways that ours do, where there's a relationship of trust? Because I think in addition to the power differential, there is a real lack of trust between the community and the agencies that provide services to clients because of this sort of coercive nature and the fact that it's involuntary. Mm-hmm. And parents are less likely to really say what they need when they know that the potential for if they don't comply in exactly the right way, the penalties can be really severe for both them and their kids, right? So we'll never be able to deliver them what they need if we are providing these services through the agencies.
Mm-hmm. Aubrey?
And I'd add in, you were talking about the program from Mayor Scott, and part of what I think has made that really successful is the use of credible messengers, right? You have people who are able to relate and understand and have been there, and that's a really important piece that I think can, even when you're in a situation where you're using a government agency, you're still able to make sure that there's a level of trust there, so that there's a deeper level of engagement, more disclosure about what's actually being needed, and better follow through on actually getting those services.
We have a caller from the Eastern Shore. Rob is on the line. Rob, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm listening with great interest. I just was actually forced to resign after being a teacher for 20 years in public schools. Because my advocacy was not appreciated, and I had bumped heads for 20 years. And
who were you advocating for?
For the kids.
Mm-hmm.
For the kids. And the thing is, what your guest is saying is true. Kids need guidance. They need, parents need support, they need better wages, but these are structural problems that require political solutions, they require social organization of people to protest, and that is difficult. Parents are there. They've chosen to have a child, and you've got to make the parent know that they have to be involved in making sure their child is making better choices. And if the child doesn't, then the parent has to be involved in somehow helping, because they're crucial. I would do what I could for the 8 hours I had a child, but, you know, that's nothing.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate the perspective. Aubrey, your response.
Rob, I'm so sorry that that happened to you in terms of being forced to resign, but I think that you're exactly the right kind of deliverer of the message in terms of having more parent engagement or trying to empower parents to take advantage of other resources. Having people who have relationships with their children, who have relationships with the parents, who are able to say, you know, this is what I think would be really helpful for you and your family, or asking them, even engaging them in the creation, the co-creation of the solution, is really important. I think Rob is the right person.
Yeah, and it's certainly true that a number of these parents of the kids who are committing these crimes are facing, you know, challenges that a lot of us can't imagine, because we have the resources that we need to live a comfortable life. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, a car that can get us to the grocery store. We have a bank that can take care of whatever, you know, bills we have to pay. We have just basic things that a lot of people don't have. But we also do share a basic responsibility for our young children. You know, if you have a kid, you've got to make sure that kid's not roaming the streets at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, you have to make sure that the kid is fed. You have to make sure that the kid has some notion of right and wrong from the earliest age, right?
Yeah, but I think, you know, your question sort of presumes that parents aren't doing that. And I think that parents are doing their best in really, really tough circumstances. And I don't think there is a parent on earth that doesn't want to make sure that their kid has food in their stomach. So if their kid is not getting the food that they need, that there's a bigger problem here, right? It means that they don't have access to employment. They don't have access to food banks. They don't have, there's nothing available in our community to support parents if they fall short through something that may be no fault of their own. And I think, you know, they're, again, going back to figuring out how we as a community can fill these gaps where the government has failed, right? There's no reason that in a country like the United States of America, there are people who are having these problems, right? We are the richest country on earth. And I just want to give a shout out, you know, Rob is a teacher, and an example of people filling the gaps where our government has fallen short is a group of teachers, a volunteer-led organization, the Maryland Child Alliance, is working on a charter amendment called the Baltimore Baby Bonus that, if it passes, will guarantee that all new parents get $1,000 when they adopt or have a child. And what research shows is measures like that, putting cash into the hands of parents, not only really increases well-being for children, it also increases their parents' well-being and mm-hmm. sets families up for success.
Yeah, and Aubrey, let me give you the last word here. I mean, the chronic absentee program that you have at your center is obviously going to, you know, help kids stay in school. And you're doing things like providing umbrellas, you know, if it's raining. You're doing really basic needs stuff. But that is a long-term thing. That is addressing the systemic issue of this. The police commissioner's in charge of, and the state's attorney and the mayor, they're in charge of stopping the carjackings right now, because mm-hmm. it's just awful to be carjacked.
Absolutely. So much terror, and we have to keep that in mind. And I think, you know, there are ways in which we need to make sure that diversion is still an option for families, for youth who need to really develop some skills around how to handle peer pressure and how to avoid engaging in behavior that's going to get them in a lot of trouble. I think the other piece is we can borrow from restorative justice models, and And I think a lot of that was kind of laid out earlier by Shanta about really taking the opportunity to develop more programs inside of our existing court structure that allows youth to assume responsibility and take responsibility for the harm that they have contributed to.
Aubrey Edwards-Lewis is the executive director of the Sarah and Neil Meyerhoff Center for Families, Children, and the Courts at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Shanta Trivedi is the faculty director. Thanks to you both for coming in. We will continue this conversation, to be sure.
Thank you so much.
And coming up after a quick break, the plant stylist Hilton Carter joins me to talk about propagating houseplants. But before we go to that break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 52 people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city. Eugene Fitzgerald, age 28, was killed the week before last. Police have identified two people who were killed last week. They are Devron Tyner, age 17, and Marvin Washington. He was 22 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back. This is 88.1 WIPR.